Doug Carr, Scott Anderson, 97.1. We're at Oakland Hills for the Detroit Sports Commission Game Above Golf Classic. All right, Scott. Obviously, a lot of people venting about the Dylan Larkin situation still, and I imagine this storyline is going to go on for some time until if and when he gets traded. I suspect he will, but I think this might take a while. If those are his only three teams, Minnesota, Vegas, and Florida, I'm not sure the Red Wings are going to be in any rush to trade him to one of those three teams, especially if they have anybody else call him with a better offer.
I suspect you're right, and I apologize for vacating the camera. But
that's okay.
It's getting a little crispy out there in the sun without protection, and I thought it'd be best if I get in a shade here.
Tarps off, boys. Tarps off.
Tarps off. I think it's a very real possibility that this trade's not going to get consummated before the draft. And I know a lot of people want it to happen before the draft because, hey, if you're going to get draft assets, doesn't it make sense? And yeah, it would, but Steve Yzerman should not be in a hurry because Dylan Larkin has requested a trade.
Yeah.
Like that's, I don't care. I really don't. I care what's best for the Detroit Red Wings. And if you want to argue that having Steve Yzerman not be in the position to make the trade, I'm not going to disagree with it, but it's the situation it is. That hasn't changed, and it doesn't sound like it's going to change anytime soon, and certainly not within the next 3 weeks.
I think the idea, and this might be the most obvious statement ever, but I don't think there's a chance in hell that Yzerman does anything less than gets market value for Dylan Larkin. I just can't see him caving and saying we're going to do it for less than market value.
Nor should he. Of course
no,
not.
No, yeah. And I mean, like I said, it might be the most obvious statement ever. This three-team list doesn't worry me.
It doesn't concern me at all. I think, like everything else, it's a negotiation. And Larkin's side of the negotiation is going to say, okay, the power that I think that I have is with the no-trade clause. Fair enough. If I have that power, then I'm going to try to wield it as much as possible. Here's my first salvo. Here are the three teams I'd like to be traded to. Now, Steve Yzerman has that information. It's up to him to do with what he pleases. Of course, he's going to look at all three teams and determine if there's a trade there that makes sense for the Red Wings. But he shouldn't just make a trade with those three teams or only look at those three teams. He needs to look at the other 31 teams in the National Hockey League, see what he thinks is the best move that he can make for this franchise. And then you come back the other way with it and say, well, look, I've looked at things that could be made with those teams, and it just doesn't benefit the Red Wings enough. And then he'll offer up what he has potentially worked out or what he's looking at. It gets tough because it is a situation where in order for him to really come back to Dylan Larkin, he has to have a trade in hand. Steve Yzerman does. So it's going to be a long process, I think, to try to flesh that out from the other teams that really have genuine interest. And I would imagine there's probably 20 teams that have genuine interest. Out of those 20, how many of them have a legitimate shot because they'd be teams that Dylan Larkin would be willing to go to? I have no idea. I think there is a percentage, though. But you got to cast a wide net, and you got to find out what's the best deal for Detroit.
248-539-9797. Carson Anderson, get your Champa Chump votes in. We do it every Monday. Who gets kudos for having the best weekend? Who should be called out for having a weekend that stunk? We get your champ and chump votes, tally them up, and post on our website on Tuesday who the people select as champ and chump of the weekend. Here comes some of those votes from an unnamed texter. Champ, Kevin McGonigal, chump, the nailer D-bag from Seattle. I hope the guy smashes his toe on a nightstand every morning.
Oh, boy.
That's better than what somebody said about
him
earlier.
Yeah, 100%. That sounds better. He looks like the kind of guy that would stub his toe on a nightstand in the middle of the night.
There you go. Champ. Kevin McGonigal virtually carrying the Tigers. The next out, K-line. Chump, Josh Naylor, wannabe hockey defenseman. Frustrated Canadian, LOL. He is Canadian. Not that that's really relevant to the purpose for the purposes of this conversation. Champ, Golden Tempo, winning the Belmont. Won my pool at work with a random draw. Chump, A.J. Hinch. Yes, the Tigers won, so it all worked out. But Hinch hitting Jamai Jones for Cole Keith in the sixth inning with the bases loaded yesterday was inexcusable. Most talked about topic today if they ended up losing.
Well, I am growing tired of the constant matchups, but the problem I have right now with the constant matchups is they've got the wrong guy in the matchup. Jamai Jones should not be on the Detroit Tigers. I appreciate what he did last year for this team. He was really good, really efficient against left-handed pitching, an OPS well over 900. But what they have right now is Jamai Jones' OPS is well below 600 against left-handed pitching. He's not hitting left-handed pitching enough to consider him a quote-unquote specialist to come off the bench. He shouldn't be here. The Tigers have other options. Options at Toledo that might be a little unproven, but there's one guy in Corey Jolks who does have nearly 500 plate appearances in the major leagues. He's 30 years old, plays the outfield, and he kills left-handed pitching, albeit at the AAA level right now. But at least what you would get is a guy who comes up to the Tigers and knows what his role is supposed to be, right? You're not wasting an opportunity by bringing up one of your prospects who's only going to play one out of 3 days or only get one at-bat a night because he's going to be used in a strategic situation. You're getting a guy who probably knows that's what his role is. He's not blocking anybody. Bring him up. Say thank you to Jermaine Jones and let him walk.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Jelks is on the 40-man.
I don't know if Jolks is on the 40-man or not, but I don't really care. I would make an easy move. I'll
DFA
get
Jermaine
rid of
Jones,
Jermaine Jones, and then there's Corey Jolks.
Yeah, there's a reason why you have journeymen with your AAA teams, guys that probably aren't long-term answers, but you kind of hope that guy can be a respectable, if they get hot, ride that wave. As far as the text is concerned, when I see the term inexcusable, that makes me think you'd fire him. If I were to use it that something was inexcusable, that means I'm making a change. And I don't know if that's what the person means. I think if you're going to make if you think that's the case, I would disagree with it. Maybe that's not how they just use it. But when I hear the term inexcusable, that tells me you would make a change.
Well,
there's no excuse for doing it. You should be fired.
Yeah, and the reason that A.J. Hinch went to that is because that's what Jermaine Jones's role is, and until Jermaine Jones, yeah, exactly, and until he's not on the roster, that's the move that he's going to make. And you know, to this point, they don't trust Colt Keith enough against lefties to deliver in that situation. They also, by the way, don't trust Kerry Carpenter enough in those situations, and he's been pinch hit for. So I would love it if they get to a point where they're winning games, and then you get a cushion where you can afford to let those guys play against left-handed pitching, and trust them like you trust Riley Green.
Mike in a truck. My champ is the Tigers for playing great baseball this past week. My chump is Scott Harris. There's no reason Zach Short or Jermaine Jones should still be on this team. I would cut them both and call up Lee and Max Clark. It's from Mike in a truck.
Well, the problem with calling up Max Clark is that you want Max Clark to play every day. And neither Zach Short nor Jermaine Jones is playing every day.
Yeah, what's the point of... What's the point of doing a show when there's a leaf blower right next to us? What's the point of calling him up to be a part-time player? He should be...
You're just messing with us right now. I mean, honestly, what are we doing?
I mean, there's a reason why the grounds here are considered immaculate.
I suppose we can't talk about how immaculate the grounds are without expecting...
One would expect that there would be a lot of work done on the grounds.
Cacophony of engineering marvels that are leaf blowers and weed whackers and trimmers and edgers and lawnmowers.
And yet, well, whatever. You can't call up guys that need to develop to play part-time roles and then expect them to develop.
No, that's why I said Corey Jolks, because I think Jolks is a guy who fits that bill.
Now,
there are a couple other guys that might fit that bill, too, guys that you're still trying to give at-bats to. They've already had Jace Young up, and Jace Young's he's hitting for power. His batting average isn't great, but his OPS is pretty good. They've got other guys that their OPS is fantastic against left-handed pitching. Jermaine Jones's is not. And it's the difference between AAA and Major League Baseball. And look, you got to find a guy that fits. Right now, Corey Jolks fits.
You want to know the timeline for one of those guys getting called up? The moment Gleyber Torres gets traded.
Yep.
Max Clark is likely in Detroit shortly thereafter. If he continues
to... Or Max Anderson.
Max Anderson, yeah. Sorry. Max Anderson, my apologies. The infielder, is he gets the call up then when Gleyber gets traded. That's
likely.
Probably the biggest thing that would make a difference. But for Mike in a truck, that might explain it. I hope that makes sense as to why you can't call those guys up now. It's Carson Anderson here at Oakland Hills. Grounds crew getting the job done. 97-1.
I think they may be out of range now, Doug.
What's that? Oh, the grounds crew?
Yeah.
They're just doing their job. Let's get back to your phone calls. We go to Neil, who's next on 97.1. Hello, Neil.
Hi, Doug and Gator. Thank you for taking this call. I wanted to make just a quick comparison of Red Wing ownership over the years, if you can bear with me here, and how history is kind of repeating itself.
Well, just as long as you keep it in under a minute and a half.
I'll try to keep it brief. So anyhow, back when the Wings won cups back in the 1950s, which was actually before my time, they were owned by the Norris family. And that ownership carried into the 60s, and Bruce Norris, the son of the owners, took over the team, and through the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, they were called the Dead Wings, and rightfully so. They made the playoffs maybe once during that time.
We all remember that era, yeah. It was
a bad
era.
We do remember it, and we kept complaining until Bruce Norris, until people stopped showing up at the arena, sold the team. And who takes the team but Mike Ilitch, who was relentless in his pursuit of the Stanley Cup, which you knew from day one. And it took him 14 years to get there, but he did get there. And he got
those non-cap years were really, really good.
Yep. But he won four Stanley Cups under his ownership.
They drafted really well, too.
And now with Chris the son, things have gone downhill. And I blame Steve Yzerman for where we're at right now, but I blame Chris Ilitch even more, because his dad would have likely not let whoever was the GM last this long. And he's running the Wings down the way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because the GM is Steve Yzerman. So I don't know. You have no idea how he would have been. I mean, if Mike Ilitch was loyal to anybody, it was Steve Yzerman. So
it's a tough one.
I have no idea how Mike Ilitch would have handled this. And look, it's Chris Ilitch's team. It's a salary cap world. It's not easy to do things, but you know, has it been too long with Steve Yzerman? People make that argument, and you can't. It's hard to argue against it.
I can't argue against it. Here's the moral of the story, though, and something everybody needs to remember: infinitum. When you hire somebody with ties, a legend, you can get into these wildly uncomfortable positions. The camp of people that are patient with Yzerman is dwindling quickly, rapidly, and understandably so. It is what it is, okay? And because of that, they're in this incredibly uncomfortable situation. But you were there firsthand through the tram years with the Tigers covering that team on a regular basis. I remember Joe Dumars. Joe Dumars won one championship as a player, won two as a player, then won one as an executive. Like, you can make a case that he's like the most underrated important Piston of all time, more so than Isaiah, because he built a team. By the way, he was building from behind the eight ball with their best player wanting out, and he took Kassoff's and put together a team and won a championship. And then he got run out of town. People got so fed up with patience with Joe Dumars. It sucks. But most people in sports get fired. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, kind of hired to be fired type of thing. And, you know, the Trammell stuff. Trammell's the coach or the manager of the team, wasn't the GM. And it's a little bit different because he's only able to do with with the roster that he has in front of him. And the years that he was there as manager, he didn't have a great roster to work with. In fact, it was a pathetic roster in large part there. So they did bring in some players eventually. Pudge and Tram didn't seem like they got along all that well. But when Tram left, then they brought in other players like Magaly Ordóñez and they ended up, Placido Polanco, they ended up putting together a pretty good roster. And, oh, by the way, they hit on Justin Verlander in the draft. So that helped and, you know, get to the World Series in 06. Love to see a quick transition with the Red Wings. I don't know if it's quick. It's going to be tough. Because if you have to trade Larkin away, you're likely getting lots of young players in return.
Those are the more likely trades, yes.
Those are the more likely trades. Now, there are some moves out there that can be made to actually get an NHL player off somebody's roster. I think it's quite possible that they involve a third team to get that type of player because if you're really going to be restricted by dealing with only a handful of teams and those teams don't have what's really necessary, then it's going to have to be spun off to another team as well to get those assets that make the trade doable.
Let's go to Tom next on 97.1. Hello, Tom. We lost Tom. Well, the one thing about the Yzerman and the Chris Ilitch thing is that we aren't privy to that would be just wonderful to hear what those conversations are like. What could Steve Eisenman say right now that would have a reasonable person saying, I'm not moving on? Could he say anything?
What could Eisenman say?
Yeah.
To ease people's pain?
Yeah. What if Steve Eisenman came on and said, here's why we believe we're going to turn this thing around quickly?
I mean, it'd be almost impossible because he'd have to get specific about players that he's looking to acquire, whether it's through trade or through free agency. It would have to be, you know, a guarantee, which you can't make any guarantees, that players that you've drafted are ready to take the big leap and make the big step, or the guys that are on this roster that are young players are ready to take another big step forward. You know, that you expect Emmett Finney to be a 50 or 60-point guy. Did you expect Lucas Raymond to threaten for 100 points? You know, that you've got assurances that Sandin Pelic is going to take a monster leap from this rookie season, which was kind of surprisingly bad for him, that he's going to be actually good, that a healthy Edvinson and next to Mo Sider looks like the most formidable duo on the blue line, and that the goaltending situation is going to work itself out, that they've got the young goaltender to be a backup this year, and that he's going to be pushing Gibson for more starts.
Here's the only thing I could think of. Is if Steve Eisenman walked in and said, today, this is the worst trade offer I've got so far for Dylan Larkin. And you look at it and you go, that's pretty good. And he says, this is the worst trade offer. Okay? I am going to do better than this. This I can do better than. And that would make me go, okay, I'm intrigued to see how it works out. Now, would I have left him in position to make this decision? No. But he's here. I just hope any mistakes he's made in the past that he can learn from, great. But, this is sort of the reality that we're dealing with.
Well, if he is truly a difficult GM to deal with, that he's stubborn, and it's the reason he's difficult to deal with is because he wants the most for what he's going to trade.
Difficult for other teams.
Yes.
Okay, not difficult and not a difficult employee.
He's difficult to make trades with because he's always trying to win the trade, which he should, and do what's best for the organization. That might be a real asset going into the summer when you've got a trade chip like Dylan Larkin, and you've got teams that are going to have to bid against each other to get him. The best thing that the Red Wings have going for him with this Larkin potential trade is that his salary is guaranteed, like his contract is guaranteed for 5 more seasons at under $9 million a season. That is a bargain in today's NHL if you're getting a number one or, say, number two center. Someone's going to be in your top six forwards at the very least, right? And that's what he is. He's a top six forward. He's a guy that can be a point-a-game guy. He's scored 30 goals in each or more in each of the last 5 seasons. He's done it 6 times in his career. He's one of the heroes of Team USA. There's a lot to like about Dylan Larkin. Now, people here in Detroit may have soured on him, and fair enough, okay? I don't care. What do you think the view is from the NHL? I think it's quite favorable. So this is a situation we talk about. You want to get multiple teams bidding on Tarek Skubal to get the most. Same thing for Dylan Larkin. Got a lot of teams that are going to want him. Hopefully it's teams that can offer you something that you really want.
Well, yeah, and it was funny this weekend. I was doing a lot of driving. Went to Chicago and back. And in the drive I was thinking, before this Larkin news broke, I was really believing that the Red Wings are absolutely screwed in that they didn't make the playoffs. They traded a first-round pick. Their young players, any development we're seeing with them, almost all of them, is extraordinarily slow. It doesn't feel like there's help. Oh, but next year they've got A, B, and C coming. Like the last couple of years of Tiger baseball, we've been thinking about McGonagall and Max Clark and players that could help them. We're going to be here eventually, and sure enough, they're getting elite contributions from one of them. Not that you could expect that all the time. I didn't see that on the horizon with the Red Wings. I thought they were in this purgatory, spinning their wheels, and they gave up a future asset, a key one, and a first-round pick, and it didn't get the job done. So now you're even shorthanded moving forward. And it made me realize, I actually think this Larkin thing might be the quickest way out to rekindle something, to jumpstart. First of all, you unload a salary, which is a bunch of money. I'd rather have the player, let me be clear. But that can be capitalized on. Mm-hmm. You are going to get assets back to repopulate the team. I just hope that the things that made Eisenman draft who he's drafted, he's learning from them and doing things differently. Because these drafts feel like it's paltry in terms of return.
Well, so far, yeah. Because the ones they've hit on Raymond, and they hit on Sider. And it looks like they may have hit on Emmett Finney, who was a late pick. But the other guys are all way unproven. Brancic Nygaard, Danielson, Casper, Sandin Pelikka, Kosa. These are all unproven assets right now.
One of the most depressing things is look at the middle rounds. Well, you got to get something out of middle rounds.
And they've got nothing.
248-539-9797. We're at the Detroit Sports Commission Game Above Golf Classic at Oakland Hills. Here on Carson Anderson on 97.1. And today, and Dan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be at Oakland Hills. Beautiful day.
And you are out here to support this event, but obviously with Detroit getting the Final Four this coming year, tell us a little bit about Detroit's bid and how that went down.
Yeah, very excited to be coming back for the men's Final Four here. Second time ever. First since 2009, as you know. The Detroit Sports Commission did a great job with Michigan State University in bidding for this event, and the Men's Basketball Committee approved it a few years ago, and now we're just months away. We come every month to the Final Four site starting in June before the April event, and so this is our first official meeting with the local organizing committee and with Ford Field and the hotels downtown, and we'll start doing some serious planning here now that we've put the 26th event to bed in Indianapolis.
How many years in advance do you need to have before you start, you know, laying things out in the future? Like the bids comes out, and then when does it come to fruition?
Well, it can be as many as 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years out. We are awarded out right now through 2031, and we'll start a new process. We'll award new Final Four sites next summer for 2032 through 2036. So you have to go far out, not necessarily because of the venues. Oftentimes the venues are available. You know, the NFL's not playing their season in April, of course. But we need to get hotels secured and convention center space secured. That's what is what drives having to do it so far in advance.
So for Detroit, what stands out about the Detroit bid? What makes Detroit unique in any way, whether it be from a challenge perspective or what Detroit brings to a table that makes it a good spot for a Final Four?
I think the passion of the community, honestly. You know, it's a great basketball area. It's the city of Detroit, the state of Michigan. There's great history here. The NCAA tournament's been held in and around the state of Michigan since 1963. There's been 46 NCAA tournament games here in four different cities across the state. Of course, Michigan State, our host institution, as well as the University of Michigan, two incredible basketball programs. So I think it's the passion. And honestly, you know, I think there was some hesitation about coming back to Detroit after 2009 because of some of the challenges that the city had. But the success of the NFL draft being here really, I think, convinced the basketball committee and staff that Detroit had come back and could host a major event like that again.
Interesting. What were some of the challenges in 2009?
Well, I'm not sure there were challenges per se. I mean, but some of the subsequent years after that, you know, obviously the city has, you know, has had its challenges, and now it's just amazing, the renaissance here and how this place has come back so strong. And is certainly, again, like I said, a great area for basketball, an area that we feel like the national championship should be played. And so it just took a while for, you know, to come back and to have that confidence it could be a really successful event again.
So how often are you scouting Detroit over the last few years? How many times have you been here to check out, make sure things are, you know, where they need to be?
Quite a bit, yeah. I mean, at least once a year. We've had regionals here, of course. Just back a few years ago, we had Purdue beat Tennessee at Little Caesars. So we've been here quite a bit. I come for regular season events as well to see Michigan State or Michigan play, Oakland. So in and out at least once a year.
All right, so you oversee the men's championship, the March Madness tournament. We've got a ton of calls about tournament expansion. I'm sure you get asked about it a ton.
Yeah, sure.
Tell us a little bit about the biggest motivating factor, because we get more people wondering why than anything else, because they think March Madness is perfect.
Yeah.
So this is something you oversee. Yeah. I ask you, why?
Yeah, great question. And we've certainly heard all the feedback. This was a 2-year-plus process the basketball committee and staff underwent to consider whether or not to expand the tournament. What's happened in Division One is that it's grown significantly. Since the last time the tournament expanded to 64 teams, and that was 1985, 40 years ago, there's 80 Division One schools that have joined that level. And there's also, as you guys well know, been huge conference realignment. The Big Ten right at the top of that list with the ACC with having 18 different schools now in the Big Ten. The SEC and the Big 12 have 16. So the reason for the expansion is that Division I's gotten bigger, and the confluence of power programs that invest a lot of money have gotten to a smaller number of conferences, bigger conferences, conferences that feel like it's harder to get into the NCAA tournament now with the field size of 68. And so that's why the committee's ultimately decided to expand to, by 8 teams. It's a pretty modest expansion, and it's really meant to meet the needs of the conferences and schools for the next 20 years. Honoring what's been so great about the tournament for the last 50 years, but evolving it because it was not in the conference's minds meeting the needs of their member institutions.
Are you at all worried that adding more teams could water down the tournament or that it may help undermine the importance of the regular season? Or should they do away with conference tournaments?
Yeah, no, I mean, first of all, it's just going to provide 8 more opportunities to for a team to come in and play as an at-large team. Those games we played on Tuesday and Wednesday, what we're going to call now the opening round. By Thursday at noon, when the tournament's first round starts, it's exactly the same tournament we've all known and loved for many, many years. It's a very small compromise to get more access where conferences and schools felt like they needed the access. Do I think it waters it down? Well, yeah. I mean, it depends on how you define water down. Will there be some more marginal teams that will be in the field now that weren't in the field? Sure. But there are teams like Texas was one of the last teams in the field this year, and they went all the way to the Sweet 16, came away from tipping from Purdue from going to Elite Eight. The quality and depth of basketball now is so great that some of these teams will certainly win games in the tournament. Do I think it's going to hurt the regular season? I really don't. I've heard that argument a lot. I think it could actually encourage power programs to play more significant non-conference games in November, December because the threat of losing, the risk of losing is much less now, having the opportunity to have 8 more spots in the field. So I think it could actually enhance the earlier part of the season. And then, the other argument that I hear sometimes is, well, schools will coast or the games at the end of the season won't be as meaningful. I don't believe that at all because teams are always going to be vying for better seeding and for regular season finish in their conference tournament. So that's just not a thing to me at all. So it is a compromise of sorts, to meet the needs, like I said, of what the membership thinks, is important for the future. Look at an ideal world. You could argue that it should be a 64-team tournament, but we went way back beyond that 15 years ago to go to 68.
Is there a crazy venue possibility in the next 10 years that nobody's even thought of that you have for the tournament?
Well, I don't know if it's crazy, but we are going to Las Vegas for the Final Four the year after Detroit. Years ago, you would never have thought that because the NCAA didn't have championships in Las Vegas for the longest time. So that'll be exciting to be on the Strip in Vegas. I don't know about crazy. We considered the great venue in Los Angeles where the Rams play. They bid for a Final Four, came real close, weren't awarded. Part of the challenge there is it's not fully enclosed. It's covered, but it has open air. It's just a big property that has. And I was there for the CFP championship game a few years ago, and they had terrible weather, rain that kind of came in almost sideways. And so I don't think we're going to risk going somewhere real crazy with the national championship because, if it's an event in November, you can recover. If it's a national championship, you got to be sure you can pull it off.
Dan Gavitt runs the March Madness tournament here. Detroit hosting the next Final Four at the Detroit Sports Commission Game Above Golf Classic. All right, so the cynic, and we get this, says it's all about money and you're on your way to 128 teams. What would you say to that person?
Well, money is important. I will not dispute that. I mean, we were able to make a deal with our broadcast partners, CBS and TNT Sports, to support expansion. It's a $300 million deal over 6 years, an average of $50 million a year. And because of that, about $130 million will go back to the membership in terms of units for basketball performance in the basketball tournaments. That's important in today's day and age with revenue sharing as it is. I don't see anywhere near 128. I'm not sure. Within the 3.5 weeks window that we have to play a tournament right now, this is the most number of teams you can have, because in order to be larger than that, you would have to move conference tournaments. There's not enough time to get conference tournaments played in the window they're in and play this event before the weekend, before the Masters on CBS. So I don't see that happening, at least not in my tenure, and I don't think anytime soon. I think 76 is really the optimal and maximum number.
Anything else new on the horizon that college basketball fans could be looking forward to? I know you guys always got stuff cooking, so anything you can hint that's coming up?
Well, you know, I mean, in this area in particular, I mean, next season should be a fantastic season, right? I mean, you know, the defending champs trying to get back here to, you know, to defend their tournament championship, the Michigan Wolverines. And, then of course, Tom Izzo's going to have a great team too, a top 10 team with some players that he has back and some great freshmen coming in. So just that alone should be very exciting for fans in this state. New things, you know. The Players Era event is an event that's now becoming more and more valuable for the start of the season. That event gets played out in Las Vegas in November. There's 24 teams that are playing in that event on ESPN. And we're going to actually tip off the season this year with a game at the Vatican between Notre Dame and Villanova, where they'll play in front of Villanova alum Pope Leo.
Wow.
Pretty cool.
Wow. That's awesome.
Who's a Chicago native.
One other thing, you're in charge of broadcasting as well.
Yeah.
Streaming.
Yeah.
How is streaming, what is it bringing to the table? Because it is something that fans are challenged with, is all the different streaming services.
100%. And, you know, there's challenge because of the expense of it, because of the, you know, the challenge of switching from devices, you know, and streaming services. What it brings to properties is younger demo, you know, younger viewers. We've seen it with the NBA on NBC. When those games are on Peacock, the average age of the viewer is 10 years younger than those fans that are watching on NBC or ABC, ESPN. And we've seen that, too, with March Madness Live for the NCAA tournament. So it is a way to bring younger viewers into fandom for your event. But it is the balance is the expense of it, the, you know, challenge of switching from one device to another or one streaming service to another, which has gotten the attention of the Department of Justice as well with the NFL, right?
Yeah. So I do have one more question.
Sure.
Between Dusty May and Tom Izzo, I'm sure you hear opinions in the head coach of Michigan and Michigan State.
Sure.
What are your conversations with those guys like?
Well, Tom tried to call me this morning, actually. Yeah, we were trading messages. Two great guys. I've known Tom much longer, known Tom for probably 25, 30 years. He is just one of the all-time best, in my opinion. Just an incredibly quality guy. Obviously a Hall of Fame coach as well. So well-respected by his peers. And cares. He puts time and effort into the game, looking after the game, serving on the NABC board. Dusty's done an incredible job early in his career. I mean, you know, taking Florida Atlantic to a Final Four appearance, and then, of course, winning the national championship this year. And he's a pretty young guy, you know, pretty, you know, relatively new in the business when you compare him to Tom Izzo, for example. So this state is blessed with two great coaches, as well as other ones, too. Greg Campy, an incredible coach.
I was about to ask you about Greg. He's opinionated as well.
He's a member here, I think.
I know he is, yeah. And a good friend and a great guy, yeah. Cares a lot about the game as well.
Dan Gavitt, Senior VP of Basketball NCAA. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate you.
It's the Detroit Sports Commission Game Above Golf Classic. And, of course, in support of the Detroit Sports Commission, which helped bring the Final Four to Detroit next spring. It is Carson Anderson here on 97.1. Champ and Chump will be posting our website on Tuesday. Both the Champ and the Chump were kind of runaways. I'll just leave it at that. We're at Oakland Hills for the Game Above Detroit Sports Commission golf outing. And, Scott, we are very close to the golf. We are not playing golf.
No.
But still a nice day to be outside.
It's Big tease.
Yeah. All right, so Scuba pitched yesterday in West Michigan, which must have been awesome for the people up there in Comstock at LMCU Ballpark, which I think is what it's called now. But, yeah, it must have been cool for people who were there.
Yes, and these people had their tickets bought way in advance. Not because of Scooble. Do you know why?
Pokemon night.
Well, you know what yesterday's date was?
What was it? June 7th?
Mm-hmm.
And what is June 7th? Is that Ferris Bueller Day? Oh, 6-7. Oh, God.
I'm not setting up a joke. That's legit. That's why the tickets were sold out.
So it was 6-7 night at LMCU Ballpark?
Yeah.
And what does that actually entail? Like, what kind of promotions can you possibly... You know what the promotion is? Nothing.
You bail and just say it's Scooble Day, I think is what you do. But nonetheless, it had to be electrifying to be there at high AA baseball. And then you get to see the two-time Cy Young Award winner come make a rehab start, throw five shutout innings, strike out? Six? He threw like 55 pitches, 44 for strikes or something. He was throwing them.
Just as long as he was healthy.
Yes, as long as you come out of that healthy and, you know, he hit near triple digits on the gun. I thought I saw 99. He feels great. He's ready to roll and will likely start in the series against Cleveland either Friday or Saturday. I imagine.
The other thing is NBA Finals Game 3 tonight. Knicks go to San Antonio and win the first two games. I think San Antonio's youth is showing up here a little bit. They're inexperienced. Their possessions at the end of at critical times in this series. I feel like when the series games get away from them, they have terrible possessions, and I kind of feel like San Antonio's youth and inexperience is showing here a little bit. And the Knicks just look like the team that is more poised on the stage. And quite frankly, that's an example of a team that found an extra gear. I mean, you talk about a team that found an extra gear and are playing above much of the way they played much of the season. I hate to do it. I very reluctantly do it. I don't want to do it, so I guess but I'm going to do it anyway. I got to give them credit.
Yeah, I know. It sucks. I mean, they played amazingly so far in the playoffs. I mean, flawlessly. And it's impressive. You can't help but come away and say that you're impressed with what the Knicks have accomplished to win the first two games on the road at San Antonio. It's incredible. I mean, we saw how the Pistons, and it was a regular season, I get it, but the Pistons manhandled the Knicks in the regular season in three games. And they won all three of those games without having Jalen Duren at their services. But they weren't even close. The two games they played against the Spurs, the Pistons looked like they couldn't match up at all because Wembanyama is this defensive hydra who altered every shot that was taken anywhere near within an 8-foot radius of the rim. And there's no way you were going to be able to drive on him and score. It just wasn't happening. The Pistons had no luck at all against San Antonio. And when we're talking about the season as it progressed and getting closer to the 60 wins, you know, I think the thought was this is a really good Piston team that's going to get to the NBA Finals, but they just can't match up against San Antonio or Oklahoma City. And yet here's the team that the Pistons dominated, and now they're up 2-0 in the NBA Finals against the team that I thought most of us thought there's no way they're going to lose to the Knicks.
Kang, I got to ask you a question, given your love and with the NBA and how long you've been following it. And what does the Pistons-Knicks regular season series mean?
I want to say it means north of nothing. So I don't want to take completely like, oh, it means nothing at all, but it, not that much. I mean, you know, you guys have heard me say it many times. Playoff basketball is different than regular season basketball. And the Pistons found out early in round one, right? Especially when a team's healthy, things change, of course. But the Knicks also got better, of course, and you can't deny that. Whether they're clicking at the right time or whatever it is, they're better now than they were in the regular season as well. The regular season is what it is. You know, some nights there's load management. Other nights it's, it's a back-to-back, a second night of a back-to-back, whatever. But it does tell me that the Pistons can match up with them. But just because they swept the Knicks in the regular season doesn't mean, oh, they're clearly a better team than the Knicks. But I don't put a ton of stock into it, if that's what the ultimate question is you're asking me.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it doesn't mean completely nothing.
Yeah, but
I'm not sure.
It doesn't mean something either, you know?
Yeah. Well,
we just think it's matchups.
Oh, matchups can matter. You're right. I mean, maybe the Pistons are a tougher matchup for the Knicks than some of who they've seen in the playoffs. I do think the Knicks, they'll found another level. Teams do that
well, they
every
have,
once
definitely.
In a while, that you just suddenly look completely unbeatable. We bring in Rico Beard, who is back at our studios and, of course, on deck with Mike.
Where's the lawnmowers?
They're off in the distance.
Guys, I can't talk to you unless I hear lawnmowers in the distance. I don't know that you're still on location.
Rico, I didn't want to tell them this, but since you're here, we do have a remote this week. It's on 696 westbound during okay. We have an interview scheduled with the road commissioner as well at 11 o'clock.
Right near the construction site.
Okay. The Woodward Overpass.
And then next week, you'll be on the 9-4. All right.
Yeah, sure.
How was your weekend, sir?
It was okay. It was okay. Yeah. Nice. It was nice outside. I was just listening to Kang. I thought Kang said that the Pistons could beat the Knicks, and I was like, oh. But he was like, he changed it in the talkback. So
I don't know if he changed it or he misinterpreted what he was saying. But
yeah, I did. I caught the tail end. So I was just
gotcha.
Like,
did you see that? What do you guys got planned coming up next?
We're actually going to talk about some three issues we have with tonight's Knicks game against the Spurs. Mm-hmm. Also, Larkin named his three teams that he would like to go to. And Doug, I don't even know what the NCAA football is anymore.
Dude, it's a joke.
First of all, I don't think he's going to play. I don't know how there's a chance in hell he can play. They found a Texas Tech-friendly judge. But if you gamble on the sport, I don't know how they could possibly
Gator,
say he can play.
I'm still waiting for Cassius and everybody in 2020 to sue and get that year back. Why not?
Hey, if they're allowing this to happen, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Have a great show. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for our crew out here. Stay safe. Treat each other with respect. It is Carson Anderson here on 97.1.